Radio Verte presents Ahuga by Corey Zimmerman.
Little Bird Blues, Act 2. Summer, 1921. People were out in the streets, escaping the stifling heat, as 15-year-old Nevaeh took her lunch on the stoop. She was tired. She'd been up since pre-dawn sewing for Harriet. She wore a blue flowered dress Harriet had bought her for Daddy's funeral, its cotton threads thinned by constant wear, permitting a bit of a breeze, though she still sat with her legs spread wide, dress hiked up to the thigh. Harriet treated Nevaeh right, but finances had grown slim on her income alone, even though she'd taken on a new boarder for the old room. Nevaeh now slept with the other youngins and helped out getting them up and around each morning for a long day of sewing and mending, for the ever-constant supply of old, worn-out overalls and such, dropped off by the ladies of men who worked down at the Southside Steelworks and the like. Occasionally, Henry would drop by to check in and offer a few upbeat words if Nevaeh was in a funk, which was quite often since Daddy passed. And Nevaeh knew it wasn't only the threads in her dress that had worn thin. Due to her burdensome presence, the other youngins were eating less. One day, eavesdropping from the stairs, she heard Harriet telling Henry as much, so Henry started dropping off leftovers and whatever else he could spare of his stockyard pay, along with those sage words of encouragement. "Been singing?" he'd ask. "Sometimes," she'd say with a shrug, but in fact, singing was the only thing that could truly lift her spirits. On the stoop that steaming hot day, she sang aloud, and she was so confused when a nickel fell jangling to her feet that she picked it up and chased the gentleman who had dropped it down the block. She plopped back down, eyeballing the shiny coin, in awe of having made her first nickel. "Feels mighty nice, don't it?" A sudden voice spoke out, alarming her, just as a dark shadow landed at her feet. She looked up, puzzled, to see a giant silhouette between her and the bright July sun. But with the squint, she saw it was only Jim, the man who had moved into her and Daddy's old room. Jim lugged his suitcase up the 3 flights of stairs just 3 weeks prior, 3 days after Harriet had advertised the old room in the front window with a card reading, "Room to Rent." Now, Jim, an overweight white man in an ill-fitted blue suit, removing his hat from his balding head to wipe the sweat from his brow, said to Nevaeh, "I'd be mighty darn proud of myself, miss. You can carry on one hell of a tune." Nevaeh crinkled her brow, looking down at the nickel. "Mind my manners," he said. "Name's William James Turner." William James Turner, part-time shoe salesman, full-time hustler. Twice divorced, one pinky lost in a game of marbles at the age of 6, Jim Turner has spent the last 3 weeks scouring the black belt for fresh black talent, settling on making his score as a talent agent, manager perhaps, spreading his pitch from the Deluxe Cafe Chicago Jazz Club to Dreamland Cafe to Royal Gardens to the Vendome Theater to the Peking and every other nightery along the State Street stroll where he was turned away by a Mr. O.C. Hammond, shoot on by a Mr. Joe Glazer, and ran off by a former street hustler turned club owner for daring to approach the throne of Joe King Oliver. Jim had stepped on the heels of enough suede and patent leather, another white, self-proclaimed jazz man who had ruffled so many lapels that Mr. O.C. Hammond's threat paled by comparison to Mr. Joe Glazer's promise. Jim, preferring not to lose another pinky, had decided to call it a day, and his prospects seemed low anyhow as he pulled a flyer he'd found on the street out of his jacket. Realizing the power of having the printed word in as many hands as possible, the Anti-Saloon League was using flyers to market their cause. And while speakeasies favored word of mouth, the illegal taverns approaching an all-time high, someone had thought to hell with it and drew one up, devoid of address, of course, that and the actual name of the joint, which would remain a scent to sniff out, leaving one to wonder, well, what the hell's the point of that? But you'd be asking the wrong person, and either way, having offered his small fat hand with missing pinky, well, here, you just might be interested in this. Go on, take a look. It ain't gonna bite, he said, as Neve eyed an illustration of a tiger with dark sunglasses, stumbling along with a stick, saxophones flanking the striped feline. You go ahead and hold on to that now, he said as she took the flyer and studied it inquisitively, not so much for its content, but for what reason he had wanted her to hold on to it. Ever heard of a blind tiger? He asked. Nope, she said. Well, it's a joint where people sing for money. People just like you, matter of fact. Who, black people? She asked. Well, yes, but no. They're what you call a black and tan. Both races welcome, intermingling and such. Lifting a foot on the step Neve sat upon to lean in closer. Well, this is just between you and me, he said, and with a whisper. A blind tiger, you see. You means them places that get people drunk? Asked Neve. I don't like them places, she said. And besides, I don't sing no jazz, I sing blues. Neve squinted up with narrow eyes. And after a long beat of scrambling for words, Jim asked. How old are you, if you don't mind me asking? 15. 15, he repeated, looking over his shoulder. Mighty good for 15. Say, is your mama around? Nope, said Neve. Do you know when she'll be back? Never, she said, buried in the ground. The ground. Well, I'm awfully sorry to hear that, he said. And what about the lady that looks after you? Harriet, said Neve. Yes, Harriet. Who is she? Asked Jim. That's Harriet, said Neve. He looked around again, awfully anxious. What about your daddy? He around? Ground, said Neve. Ground too, I see. I'm sorry to hear that too. Look, who looks after you? Harriet, said Neve. Okay, Miss Harriet. Okay, well, you think I could have a word with Miss Harriet? Why don't you ask her yourself, mister? Anyhow, why are you so nervous? Asked Neve. Because you's a white man talking to a 15-year-old black girl in Bronzeville? And you old? Old? I don't know if I'd say old. Older than you, of course. Well, I gotta go, said Neve, standing and handing the flyer back to Jim as he contemplated his mortality. Wait. Look here. And this would have been the point where Jim laid down his pitch, as he had in those dimly lit juke joints, saying with all sincerity, you got real talent. I mean it. You got something special that most musicians, they just don't have. You know, I work with a few industry insiders, and I see a lot of potential in you. Have you ever felt like you were just one step away from making it big? Leaning in closer, speaking conspiratorially. What if I told you I have a unique opportunity that could change everything for you? I represent a boutique label that specializes in discovering raw talent just like yours. And look, I'm not like those big guys that just chew you up and spit you out on the sidewalk. We believe in artists and their craft. Hand on the shoulder. Here's the scoop. We offer a contract that includes studio time, marketing, and even a small advance to get you on your feet. You know, get yourself a new suit, some shoes, take the lady out for a steak, porterhouse. Look, I know things are tight, but this could be the big break you've been waiting for. I'll help you create a polished demo, book gigs, and even connect you with influential people in the industry, all the while flashing a charming smile spread wide across his fat, jolly face. Look at me, he might as well said. I'm well fed. But he carried on, saying, now I know what you're thinking. What's the catch? But I assure you, it's all straightforward and airtight, straight as an arrow. All you need to do is sign this agreement right here. Here's the pen. And we can start working right away and get your star in the sky before you know it. Lowering his voice to create a sense of urgency. But here's the thing. I can only take on one artist. So, gesturing to the contract, the sooner you sign, the sooner we can turn your dreams into a reality. And with full flattery, you deserve this. And I genuinely believe, together, you can make it to the top. What do you say? Gesturing to the flyer before Neve. You know what, here? He said as he hurriedly searched his pockets. Here, take this. Call it a down deposit. As he handed her 5 crumpled up $1 bills. Now you spend that on whatever you darn please. And when you do, I only ask one thing of you in return. You stop and think about just how good that feels. We got a deal? Nevaeh looked down with a look of disgust at the damp wad of cash in his hand, but with a sideways nod and a shrug of the shoulders. "Okay," she said, clenching her hand around the bills before returning inside. "Okay then," said Jim, straightening his tie as the screen door slapped shut on his toes. Miss Harriet, it's William James Turner." "Afternoon, Jim," Harriet's voice carried out through the screen. "Well, you can call me William James," said Jim. "Well, anyhow, could I have a word with you for just a moment? I think I have an investment opportunity you just might find attractive." No, I'm not after your money, Miss Harriet. But if you just hear me out, I believe that you might find you're sitting right on a gold mine, yes indeed." The 98-seat theater that Bill Littlebird hushed as a single spotlight gleamed down upon a young figured silhouette wrapped tightly in a glittery red dress. Lips glistened but kept pursed in silent and static wait until the crowd began to murmur and shuffle about as each quiet moment passed, the bedazzlement starting to wear thin until the drop of a single note of ivory and a single word, "Blue." Applause erupted, the confounded crowd clapping, stomping, and whistling. Little Bird scurrying backstage out of the limelight as Jim, who held his arms out wide in glee, "Chicago loves you," wrapping his large arms around her. And below a thick layer of carefully applied makeup, heavy on the mascara, the 15-year-old eyes of Nevaeh winced at Jim as he wiped his sweaty brow with exultation, saying, "And oh boy, they're gonna love you in Kansas." And they would, with the raw meatpacking blues Daddy had taught her. She'd perform at a joint on the corner of 18th and Vine. "A golden ticket, I tell you," said Jim, just out of earshot, as he threw his suitcase in the back of his Model T in the parking lot of a KC hotel. And after Kansas City, as Harriet had signed guardian rights away to Jim for 6% sales, Jim drove the 15-year-old girl across state lines once again, heading on to St. Louis, where she sang of finding her gambling lover Jimmy messing with a pretty young thing, leaving her high and dry. The crowd ate it up. Such raw talent. The stout yet gentle voice of such a young girl. "Can you believe it?" zigzagged between astonished eyes. Little Bird, all dolled up, of course, to look an age. Age enough, to say the least. But it was the fact that such a voice rolled off the tongue and bellowed out of the bowels of such a young, young gal was the shtick that Jim just could not disavow. Not with the gains he was walking away with. He was a salesman after all, a salesman selling virgin talent. And the fish were biting, and when the fish are biting, why change lures? The mosquito was out for blood. In Memphis, Little Bird sang with a jug band, sucked the meat off the bone, so to speak. And in Little Rock, Totsy and the Texas Flood joined her on stage, flooding the joint with applause. Still, it was Little Nevaeh, and everyone knew it, who caught the heart of every soul who caught wind of her song. And William James Turner was right. She was a golden ticket, with a fat stack of bills stashed in his suitcase to prove it. Next stop, the Deep South. The Deep South. Tennessee riverboats and mountain jazz. Alabama hurtin' and them mean dog blues. Mississippi barrel houses and barns out on the outskirts of town. Juke joints one across the road from the other, where Nevaeh echoed the ghosts of the pioneers. The Deep South. Shady jazz and dirty blues. And one hell of a story to write home about, be it there was anyone there to read it. So many sights to be seen, the adventure of a lifetime. Nevaeh soaked in the horizon when she wasn't sleeping in the back seat, like the time when William Turner made a wrong turn in Jackson and they ended up having to tie up loose ends at a brothel in Crystal Springs. And hell if Nevaeh didn't make more good friends with them ladies. The most interesting folk she'd ever met, she'd say. The next night, Jim, in a peculiar light mood, used the earnings to get Nevaeh her own room at the Natchez Hotel, telling Little Bird, "You earned it." The Natchez Hotel, opened in 1891, was the grandest building ever built in the Mississippi town. The Weekly Democrat described it as the finest and most completely equipped hostelry in the South. The McHenry brothers, who had relocated to Natchez from Louisville, Kentucky, designed the joint and forked over about $100,000 to have it built. The Natchez had 52 guest rooms, described as German Renaissance in style. the dramatic focal point of the hotel, an octagonal corner tower topped by an arcaded octagonal dome. The hotel's main entrance on Pearl Street opened into a lobby whose ceiling extended the height of a 4.5-story building. Balconies encircling the lobby on each side of the intervening floors. The hotel contained a tobacco and newsstand, barbershop, gentlemen's reading room, lavish bar, and billiard room. A special ladies' entrance on Franklin Street provided access to a ladies-only waiting room. The hotel's second story featured 4 parlors, and the 4th story contained a large dining room with an elevator to elevate the public and staff. The Natchez, possibly the finest-looking hotel in the state. But the Natchez had once suffered a blow to the eye when a tornado tossed its distinctive dome clear out of town in 1907. By the time Nevaeh stepped through the heavy oak doors of her own Victorian room, the hotel had been thoroughly refurbished, its iron masks standing strong. The room had a scent of lavender, mingling with the rich aroma of aged wood, which overwhelmed her. The room was bathed in a warm, golden light that spilled from an ornate chandelier above, its crystals glimmering like stars against the high, intricately adorned ceiling. But her eyes were more immediately drawn to the grand 4-poster bed, its dark mahogany frame towering majestically in the corner, draped in sumptuous fabrics, velvet and silk and deep shades of burgundy and gold that cascaded elegantly to the floor. Pillows, plush and inviting, beckoned her to sink deep into their softness. Intricate plaster moldings framed the walls, covered in rich, patterned wallpaper, as floral and damask motifs danced across the surface. The furnishings were beautifully carved, with surfaces gleaming with the sheen of polished wood. A vintage mirror with an ornate frame reflected Nevaeh's bright eyes back at themselves. She spun around on the floor, a patchwork of polished wood boards and intricately patterned rugs, feeling their warmth beneath her feet, and in the bathroom, a clawfoot tub surrounded by delicate tiles and a pedestal sink, above which another elegant mirror reflected Nevaeh's disbelief. Closing the heavy drape, she laid in the vast bed, basking in the soft glow of the lamp that wrapped her in a warm embrace, making her feel as though she'd stepped into a dream where everything was right. 'Cause hell, the world was off, and she knew it by now. And what they said was right was too often wrong, and what just felt off was often too much the case. The world as Nevaeh Little Bird knew it was quite unfair, and those ladies at the brothel had warned her as much when they had brought her a big bowl of creamy seafood bisque. Yes, Jim Turner had made one wrong turn after another, assuming the South was just as insatiable for the likes of fresh talent, unassuming and underestimating that the deeper South he drove. All anyone saw was an old white man exploiting the likes of a young black gal, a gal who looked just like their daughters, and who had been run ragged on the road by a man who looked just like the taxman. And in a rural juke joint, the taxman is not someone anyone wants to be after midnight. But there was one thing Jim had overestimated, as he was quick to find out. There wasn't too many a dime to spare in the many barrel houses of the South, which he had caught gigs for tips. No matter how good a shaker he was, not in a ramshackle joint, where the crowds all smashed together, where the walls were stained up to the shoulder, where sweaty sharecropper folks who spent the greater portion of their lives in the field and who owned hardly a pot to piss in, but had a few bits for whiskey, for a few fingers of bourbon on a Saturday night. And as remarkable a show as Little Bird put on, to outbid a pint, and hell, a quart? Forget about it. So night after night, William Turner sat back and watched his wad dwindle on hotel rooms, gas, and an insatiable love affair with food. He'd crack that whip per se, and Nevaeh would sing her heart out. But time and time again, sharecropper folks spent the last of their dimes slugging off the long week rather than tip the hat of a white man. And a familiar pattern emerged as a familiar set of objects, events, actions, and sounds of failure began to repeat yet again, as they had tended to do throughout Jim's life of scamming and scheming. A familiar pattern, wailing under pressure, hatching up a quick scheme to keep the sinking boat afloat. And when a truckload of eggs rolled up outside a barn saloon one night, Jim asked, "How much for the whole load, truck and all?" Jim's quick scheme, drain the eggs, fill them up with bootleg liquor, seal them back up with a dab of glue, and no one would ever be the wiser, not cops nor customs. So early the following day, as the vase soaked in the clawfoot tub at the Natchez Hotel, William James Turner tiptoed out of his room, suitcase in hand, to meet up with the feller from the barn saloon out front. Jim traded this feller his Model T and $200 cash for the egg truck and its load of eggs and hit the road, following a hand-drawn map to the nearest bootleg. And by the time Neve was drying off with a Turkish cotton towel, William Turner was heading up the Great River Road with the Delta in his rearview mirror. The Delta, a source of great fiction and fancy, travel, history, and tales, accounts of gold and glory, of death and disease, yet an air of permanence of those who belong to the river, those well settled below the bluffs and the prairie beyond, a sensational land alive with the soulful ethos and folk stories abound. The Delta, home of the blues, of countless crossroads where good folk make hard decisions. Now, what to do about this Negro girl who approached the concierge desk to profess that she cannot foot the bill? "Where's your daddy?" the concierge asked the petite girl with two short braids still dripping wet. "He ain't my daddy," said Neve, who nearly rested her chin on the desk, small suitcase at her feet. "Well, where's the gentleman you arrived with?" "Who, Jim?" "Don't know." "So he left you here all by your lonesome without paying the bill." And on it went, a debate amongst staff whether to just write off the balance and send the youngster along her way, wherever that may be, not their business nor problem, versus what will we tell the boss? Tell the boss what? The older of the two McHenry brothers, Robert, asked as he entered the lobby unexpectedly with his wife, Anne. "Look, mister, I can sing," said Neve, eager for a solution. "Why not a song to sing off the balance?" she thought. "You can you?" said Mr. McHenry, still somewhat confused at the situation he had walked in on. "Well, it's here, dear," said Miss Anne, as Mr. McHenry insisted that someone please, in the name of God, kindly explain the matter that had consumed the entire concierge staff, the manager and deputy manager, plus both bellhops, the head of housekeeping, two of her maids, the French chef, the accountant, another arriving housekeeper drawn in by the melodrama, and the porter, mighty keen on any spectacle to stir up the otherwise repetition of days. Mr. McHenry might have wondered, where's the engineer, as not a single other task was being tended to. And while he tried to wrap his mind around a matter being explained in no less than a half a dozen points of view and tones of voice amongst the chattery chaos of the now crowded lobby, Little Bird began to sing. And I tell you, someone could have heard a grasshopper break its leg, the way the concierge desk fell silent, and remained silent, as Mr. McHenry spun around on his heels. And for seconds after Little Bird finished her song, it was not until Miss Anne shouted "Bravo!" with a quick succession of claps that those guests who had been drawn into the lobby by the siren song had begun to applaud. "Bravo! Bravo!" It was the billiard room Neve enjoyed the most, where after dusting chalk off the mirrors and polishing the room, heavy laden in cherry, Neve would shoot pool with the cooks in the wee hours of the morning, but not before helping them scrub the last of the pots and pans. She even taught a thing or two about potatoes and grits to the French chef, who allowed her to don his tall chef's hat as he taught her how to braise lamb. Neve got her hair trimmed by the in-house barber, and when no white folks were around, he even let her sit in the chair, where she would spin round and round before the large arched mirror, before sweeping up clippings from the checkered tile floor. She'd pull up to the mahogany bar and drink a fruit punch, Catawba punch, raspberry punch, Loganberry highballs, pineapple freezes, orange fizzes, grape juice rickies, grape lemonade, and orangeades when she wasn't busy washing glasses. Though Neve had spent that first night at the hotel catching up on sleep in the hotel's finest suite, She now slept in a broom closet converted to a bedroom. But still, often the maids would let her sleep in a guest room when occupancy was low, where she would again lavish in its luxuries, taking long baths in the clawfoot tub, jumping on the king-size bed, and sleeping in those luxurious Egyptian cotton sheets, drifting away to a more perfect world upon goose-down pillows until noon on Sundays. But one Sunday, Miss Anne, refusing to ride the streetcar alone, dragged Nevaeh out of bed and off to church. Still, despite an angry shouting match between Miss Anne and the head of the congregation, with Miss Anne shouting, "The Savior said, 'Behold, I stand at the door and knock, and if any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him and I will sup with him.'" It was of no use. No Negroes read the sign. Hearing word from the porter during daily gossip, Mr. John, the old black man who kept the stove hot and the boilers boiling, decided the following Sunday he'd take Nevaeh along on the streetcar to the north end of town to sing her heart out with the Rose Hill Missionary Baptist Church Choir and their Moeller organ. However, it was the dining room of the Natchez Hotel, settled in a nest of twigs that burned ferociously in the colossal wood stove that sat piping hot in the middle of the large room, thanks to Mr. John, amongst full oak tables topped with the very white linens she helped iron, in the buzzing electricity of two grand chandeliers that Little Bird, draped in fiery plumage, made the daddies cry and the mamas weep to those bluest melodies. When darkness descends, joy is buried deep, and the weight of the world falls from the sky, a pyre of grief, reducing the bird and her nest to ashes. As from those ashes, de nouveau, a pledging phoenix arose, renewed and reborn.
Bravo!